Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more. Words cannot describe the effect that Nelson Mandela had on the world. The global hero, renowned pacifist, and South Africa's most famous head of state sadly died at the age of 95 on Thursday, December 5th. Nelson Mandela was deprived fresh food in prison, but later in life had his own personal chef and was able to eat some of the best meals in the world. Surprisingly, his favorite food was tripe. Nelson's personal chef, Koleswa Nadua, a Queenstown native, had been cooking for Mandela since 1992 and even put out a cookbook featuring Mandela's favorite recipes. Featured recipes include umphokoko, a porridge made of maize meal and sour milk, and sweet chicken, a beloved dish that turns dinner into a competition, writes granddaughter Nandi Mandela. Dr. Makazeev Mandela, the daughter of Nelson, founded House of Mandela Wines with her daughter, a label inspired by the values of Nelson Mandela. They work with fair trade certified wineries that respect the biodiversity of the land. We hope you'll do your own research on the life and body of work of Nelson Mandela and spend some time paying tribute in your own way. We certainly will be reflecting on his legacy and hoping that others will follow his examples of peace, love, and kindness.
Welcome to The Main Course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. It's a packed house out there at Roberta's, and it is a packed house here in the studio. We have Goran Ristic in from a friend of the neighborhood and an important component of the Meatball Shop, a very successful restaurant group. We're also going to be talking to Frank Reese, a very important farmer. I argue he has the most important farm in America. It is literally a cesspool of biodiversity. There is so much biodiversity on his farm, you can get sick just like driving by. So much going on there. It's a fascinating place. And we are engineered by Joe Galarraga. Joe, are you asleep yet, Joe?
I am awake. How's it going, Patrick?
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, that was a great piece by Jack. As people should know by now, the Heritage Radio Network has added a news component to the homepage, and they have 4 to 6 news stories, 2 to 3 minutes long, can be as long as 7 minutes, that cycle in every single day or 5-6 days a week. So that piece was a good piece about Nelson Mandela, and it was very interesting to hear that he likes tripe. I mean, if only we had followed through with that opportunity to open a South African distribution center, we could have been selling him that tripe. But no, we stayed national. So it has been a very busy week. We missed last week's show because we had thousands and thousands and thousands of turkeys going all over the country. It was a big day. I mean, it is not easy to save an endangered species, and the turkeys we sell are indeed endangered. And it takes really a village to save them. And it's not just the farmer, and it's not just the buyers, and it's not just Heritage, but it's people, truckers, and it's FedEx people, and it's box companies and ice companies, and people that make machines to print labels and tracking numbers. I mean, it is really an unbelievable project. But most recently, I logged on to the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy website, and I noticed that two of the breeds that we've been working with this past decade are now off of the critical list and the threatened list. So they're now on the watch list, meaning they have been upgraded to a population counts that mean that they're no longer on the bottom two lists. So watch is definitely a lot better than threatened and critical. So we're very excited about that. And it's a tribute to all the hard work everyone has done. But anything else go on, Joe? Any great stories? Huge guests this week on the Heritage Radio Network?
I'd say just keep tuning in. There's always something good going on. I'm trying to remember what my favorite stuff was from this past week, and I'm having a little bit of a
blank.
The
homepage is just unbelievable, though. I mean, there's not Jay-Z is going vegan. I learned
that. Oh, that's right.
He's going vegan for 3 weeks. And or 21 days is 3 weeks, and I thought that was interesting. I actually learned about that on the Heritage Radio Network.
Another great piece that we have is the entire Museum of Food and Drink roundtable discussion about the soda ban. Mm. So if you want to listen in to hear some really interesting people, they had a straight up libertarian arguing. They had Joel Berg was talking, and moderated by Cooking Issues own Dave Arnold, and I was there on site doing the recording. It was a blast. So
very, very cool. Yeah, you went all the way up to Harlem to broadcast that. And I personally think just on that issue, it should be 21. Until you're 21, there's a limit on the size of the soda, and then after 21, you can buy a 30-gallon soda. Anyway, but yeah, no one thinks carding your soda purchase. But and then we also Pat lost a great chef this week. She died of appendix cancer. It's Judy Rogers, the not the founder, but the energy behind Zuni Cafe, which is one of the most well-known restaurants in all the country. So she very sadly passed away, and Heritage Radio Network was one of the first news organizations to cover the passing of Judy, and it interviewed Nancy Silverton from Mozza. We also interviewed Russ Parsons, the editor of the LA Times food section. So Michael Tusk, the chef of Quince, who's celebrating their 10th anniversary. So it was quite a group of people to come to support her, and she will be sorely missed. She was greatly loved, an alum of Chez Panisse, and Zuni is still there and packing the house every day. So we will miss her. So we'll take a quick break and come back with Gorin, and we're going to do a little test for our listeners. We're going to put out some famous people from his country and see if anyone can guess where he's from. So stay tuned, and we'll talk about Central Europe.
You're listening to Goes Black by Big Ups on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Like the pace of my life's too fast, and I think about the time that's passed. I can't remember what happened yesterday, the day before, or anything, at any rate, anyway. I think what I'm trying to say is, I don't want to live a life like this. What happened to all those black and I'm lying there dying, and I'm trying to think back, and I can't seem to conjure up anything, and the fear consumes me as I start to lose me. What happened to all those black and I'm lying there dying, and I'm trying to think back, and I can't seem to conjure up anything, no, because I haven't done anything. I feel like I've led a pretty happy life, and how come all I can remember is the strife?
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
West. Well, thank you to Hearst Ranch. They helped fund the purchase of these shipping containers in 2008 and 2009 when they were put in. So we're very appreciative of them. So we live in an age of Google, so people will have to email or Twitter or Facebook or call into the show in the next 10 seconds to find out. And they'll get something free, like a free salami from Heritage Foods, if they can do that. Our next guest comes from the same country as Marina Abramovich and Nikola Tesla and Novak Djokovic.
That's correct.
And also Vlade Divac, the famous D-Voc, the famous center for the Los Angeles Lakers and the Sacramento Kings, but he won the championship with the Lakers and Magic Johnson. Goran Ristic is from Serbia. Welcome, Goran.
Thanks, Patrick. Nice to have you to be here.
So I'm a big fan of yours from the neighborhood, and you work very closely. Tell our listeners, what do you do?
Hey, hello. This is Goran, and I'm a chef of a meatball shop, one of the chefs of the meatball shop company. I actually do the work in a commissary kitchen where all the meatballs are produced and most of our sauces. So I hope you like our food and enjoy it.
Tell us exactly what happens. I mean, you make how many different types of balls, and how does it work? I mean, just give us a brief summary before we talk about Serbia, which is what most of the interview will be about.
So the meatball shop is like very straightforward food. Like, we don't have any secrets about it, and like, we are like making convenient food. Like, and whatever like you eat and you like to eat, it can be made in a form of a meatball. So we have over like 60 different types of meatballs on the menu. Wow. But like, we have like four classic standard, which is like beef, pork, chicken, and veggie balls. And every week we are changing like in a different special ball. Depends how do we feel about it and what the season is, of course.
Very interesting. And how many meatballs will you make in a week or a month or a year?
Oof, that's a big
calculation.
It's easier to do it daily. It's around like 13,000 meatballs every day.
13,000 meatballs.
Yes,
a day.
We have like five very like successful restaurants, so like we feed a lot of people. So
yeah,
people,
it seems like a meatball shop is opening every day. I mean, you know, or in every neighborhood now almost.
We are trying to cover majority of the New York City, and then we'll see.
And how many employees are you supervising to make all these meatballs at the commissary kitchens that then get shipped to the various restaurants?
Not that much for that huge volume. Actually, okay. I have 12 employees in the facility,
okay,
plus pastry chef, and like she have also two assistants.
So very interesting. Like, well, we're big fans of the meatball shop, and you know, go there, and it's a very cheap food. But they use very high-end ingredients, so it's a great combination.
That's the beauty of a meatball. So we can afford to use high-end ingredients because we don't use like the most popular cuts. So we can afford to buy heritage meats from you guys and like grind it and make delicious meatballs.
It's funny, the word meatball used to be a huge insult in America in the 1920s. You're like, you're a meatball, the guy would kill you. He was entitled to kill you. It would be like sleeping with his wife or something. It was the worst. But so tell us, when did you come to this country from Serbia?
I came like 2008, beginning of it. Actually, it was like February.
Why? What prompted you to leave all your family and friends behind and just come to Brooklyn?
Why not? Very simple, yeah. Like, why not go experience something else, do something else, learn something new, meet new people? It's great to go around. So I'm like always like trying to find something new and exciting in my life. So this was like a good opportunity. Why not?
Had you been thinking about it for a long time and then finally did it?
No, I was like thinking never to come to America to live. I was always like a fan of the Europe, but I had the opportunity and like, why not? Like,
what was the opportunity? Just you had a friend here or family? Or
I had like a couple of friends and I like get the working visa and the job. So why not? Like, it's easiest, like easy, very easy to go back home if you don't like it. So I gave it a shot.
Did you get the job there?
No, I actually like have a friend who have a restaurant over here, and it was like not like right away, oh, you're going to get the job, but it was like open like space to get. And it's like in our profession, it's very easy to get the job. If you know your job, it's not a problem.
And does America make it easy for Serbians to come? I mean, is it?
Not at all. Not at all. It's like the most challenging part is like getting a visa for America.
Interesting. And you had to convince them that you would be a constructive part of society and that you had a job lined up, all that.
Everything, and plus like many, many other things. Yeah, it's kind of
Do you have to pay under the table a little bit in
Maybe
Serbia?
Like 10, 15 years ago, but like that doesn't work anymore. Like now we're a legal country, so everything is by the books. That's what they say.
Are you part of the European Union?
Not yet. We are trying to get there, but like they don't like us that much, and I don't think that's like very smart idea, because like European Union is bringing like some other restriction food-wise, like, so you cannot produce this amount of certain, like, food or beverage because it's, like, regulated by European Union. And that's,
well, you're not as lovable as a people as the Germans, for instance. Everybody loves the Germans.
Yeah.
How could, no, just kidding. The Germans
we are actually very lovable.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
That. Yeah.
But why don't they want you in? Is it because have something to do with the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, or is it just
I think it's, like, yeah, probably something majority is from there. The other part is like the First World War, like we...
Oh, you started it, didn't you?
Yeah.
It happened, some count or something got murdered in his...
Not the counter, the Tsar was like assassinated by Serbian dude, like, but they were like occupying our country and he came and the dude killed him. So yeah, killed the occupator and that's what actually started the First World War.
Wow.
But we won.
You want to get...
Yeah, so that's the reason the Germans don't like us much. But
very interesting. So tell us, growing up, you grew up in a big city or a small town?
Actually, I was born in a small town, and like my childhood was there. And then, like when I got hit the teenage age, I moved to the capital of Belgrade, and that's.
And you moved there yourself or
yes.
Your family?
No, by myself. Yeah.
And what did your parents do?
My mother is like a housewife.
Okay.
She doesn't work do anything, and my father is like having some private business, but I wouldn't know how to express myself in English for that.
Okay. So tell us, the small town was named what?
Trstenik.
Trstenik.
Yeah.
Joe, just tag that right now. I'm sure you don't need to spell check that or anything. It has no vowels in it. That's a hint. But tell us, so it's a small town, and where is that related to in Serbia? Is that in the south and the
that's
north?
Central Serbia.
Central.
That's central. Serbia is like a very small country. We used to be a Yugoslavia, which was like also a small European country, but like we break in like 8 parts. So now we have like 8 smallest countries. Oh, actually, this is there is a 9th part. Kosovo is now like new country, like also piece of Serbia, which is like went out, but whatever. So, like, we're a very small country, central Serbia or, like, eastern Serbia, it's, like, 200 miles.
Oh,
like,
really? The whole country?
Not, yeah.
But Belgrade is the capital.
Belgrade is the capital.
And that's where there was more action going on, and so you picked up one day and you just went and found a place to live and got a job and...
Actually, I went to school and some, but, like, that was, like, the actually, like, majority of, like... my interest and like the music and happenings was like happening, and a lot of my friends are from Belgrade, so it was like I was living in a small country, in a small city, I was like spending most of my time in Belgrade. So in one moment it was like just like natural, okay, I'm not gonna go home anymore, I'm gonna just stay here. Yeah.
So tell me, what foods did you grow up eating, and other kids of your town or region? I mean, you would grow up eating for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I'm interested because we never had someone from Serbia on my show.
So, like, the Serbia is having, like, really very interesting geographic position. We are, like, in the middle of the Balkans, like, two huge rivers, like Danube and Sava, two biggest European rivers are having a delta in Belgrade. So, like, and that's, like, the literally a border between east and west. So we got like the clash of the old cultures. So we have influence from Austrian cuisine, from Turks, from Greeks, from Italy, and it's kind of a mixture. And the beauty of that Serbian cuisine, it's like about the produce. It's not about like spicing the cooking. It's the high quality produce, and it's like very simple, very like straightforward. Salt, pepper, meat, potatoes, but it's delicious.
And you have a good growing season there? Is that why you have...
Yes, yes. It's like we have 4 seasons like everyone else, but it's like really, really like a great, great place for crops and everything, yeah.
So what's so breakfast, you had what, pancakes and waffles, or did you have croissants and brioche?
More like most of the breakfast is actually a burek, which is like something like not puff pastry, it's a phyllo dough like filled with the cheese, meats, or other different types of fillings. And like majority of the breakfast food is coming from a bakeries that eat a lot of bread.
Fresh breads,
like croissants and like biscuits, whatever. So like,
and it's is lunch then a big meal, or is dinner the biggest meal?
The lunch is a big meal, and dinner is pretty decent also. Yeah.
And do people go home for lunch, or do they eat lunch out? Do they bring their lunch?
That's like the before the wars and everything what was happening, people were eating out in restaurants like any other normal country. But like during the 90s, all of that stuff what was happening, the people became very, very poor, so nobody could actually afford to go to the restaurants, and the restaurants are starting like to shut off. So we had like 90s were like really bad era of like Serbia and Yugoslavia, and actually whole Balkan was like in a war in the flames, and it was like really bad to sustain over there.
Now, what are the and dinner, what are some of the key dishes? I mean, is it basically the American equivalent of like meatloaf and steak, or were there certain dishes that were particular to your country?
Basically, like the Serbian diet, it's very, very, very meaty diet.
Really?
So it's like some grilled meats, like stewed meats,
pork,
like
pork,
lamb, chicken, all meats, everything what walks, like we're eating.
You will eat it.
Yeah, so it's kind of everything goes, ducks, feathers, everything.
Yeah, I know, we spend a lot of time talking about that stuff. We'll talk more about it. So when the Yugoslavia broke up, are still the food traditions very similar across the eight regions?
The whole, everything is the same. Like
basically, because it was one country before, for thousands of years.
And it's the same people. Like, we're all the same. Like, we're Slavic people. They say so, whatever. But, like, the only difference is, like, the religion. Serbians are, like, Orthodox. Croatians are Catholics, and Bosnians are Muslims, but we are the same people, and that's the all the conflicts are starting. But we
for religion, but food wise and
language wise, food wise, culture wise, everything else is the same.
Pork is everywhere, but the bullshit is not.
Yeah, just in Bosnia, they don't eat pork. Everything else is the same.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
This is a test of your geography. Can you mention the nine regions? Kosovo is the newest one. It's ninth. Can you mention the other eight?
Let me see. So, yeah, I can. Maybe it was like eight altogether. Let's try it. It's kind of a Slovenia. They like separated the first, then Croatia. Then we have Bosnia and Herzegovina. Then we have Macedonia. Then we have Serbia. Then we have like Kosovo. And actually, I overreacted with like, and that would be all. Now Vojvodina, maybe it's going to like go away, but let's see. Yeah, and that's it. Yeah. And okay. Montenegro, of course.
And Montenegro. Yeah. So seven regions.
Seven,
very
yeah.
Interesting. And what started this? What were they all rebelling against? Was a what city or what force were they rebelling against? What were they making themselves independent from?
From like I don't know. That's a really good question for some much bigger authorities than me. Nobody actually have like the right answer. But like it's easy.
They were just fighting basically for religion.
Not
freedom.
Everything started with the crash of the economy. So when the people are like poor and hungry, it's really easy to put them in the argue. Okay, it's their fault. They're like because of them we are poor now, and that's basically what started the whole conflict. Couple of pyramidal structure schemes, you know, like people got robbed for the money, and when you're poor and angry, it's easy to get in a conflict.
So you really grew up during war?
Yes, not one. Three wars and one bombing, yeah.
And you were in danger then.
But basically, like, on the territory of Serbia, and Belgrade was never, like, in war, because, like, we were, like, centralized, and everything was, like, happening on the borders.
I see.
But, like, majority of the people went in the wars from Serbia.
Did you ever fight?
No, thank God.
There wasn't a mandatory army?
It was, but I managed to avoid it, and, like...
God, there you gave some money to somebody.
No, I just, no? like, I was pretending that I'm, like, not mature enough to go in war and kill the people, okay?
You were making fun of the generals interviewing you. That no, that's funny. That's wow, good for you. You're a good actor because you are very mature. Well, we're about to have Frank Reese, the preeminent farmer, but to segue into that, you say there are all these unifying traditions even though the country split into seven parts. What are some of the great culinary traditions? I mean, I take it Christmas and New Year's Eve, but tell us some great national holidays and what foods are associated with them, and then we'll bring Frank in and talk about turkeys.
So we were like a communist country after the World War II, like for like 40-something years. So we have like those like communist traditions, like 1st of May, Revolutionary Day, like 29th of November, and those were like the big like... food feast. Like,
and what would you eat? Just meat. There was no particular animal associated with it.
In Serbia, the most favorite animal, it's pig. Like, because like the Serbia before the First World War was like the biggest exporter of like the pork in the whole Europe.
Huh.
So, yeah, maybe you're familiar with Mangulica and those kind of breeds. They're coming from Serbia. So.
Wow, that's your number one heritage breed, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they sell the Mangulica pork collar here at Roberta's. So, revolutionary on... Revolutionary Day is November 29th.
Yeah, and May 1st, that was like, that's a big thing.
What's that?
That's like also some like...
some independence.
Something like workers, freedom, blah, blah, blah. You know, communist thing. And like, that's one of the biggest. And of course, like, even if we were like communists, like people like used to celebrate the Christmas like secretly from the regime. And like that tradition also exists. And like the biggest thing... In all of these gatherings in Serbia, it's like pork roast.
Pork roast.
Pork roast, yeah.
And you say you ate anything that walked. What about the turkey? I know it's an American animal that came to Europe and then came back to the United States for the turkey that we know, but those European ones that stayed. What interaction did you have with them in the Yugoslavia area?
The turkey is like very, very like a common bird in that area, but it's not, we don't give it like a big deal like over here. Like it's not like something traditionally that we eat, but mm-hmm. it's like on the menu from time to time.
Very nice. Well, here it's on the menu, as you say, all the time. I mean, you can't go to a deli in America and not get a turkey sandwich. But the whole bird, as an event, as a centerpiece, happens, as we all know, on Thanksgiving. All different types of cultures celebrate it. And for years, people have been celebrating a real shitty turkey. And no one really knew that there were different breeds of turkeys and different genetics. And thanks in large part to this man we're about to talk to, people understand that about turkey, but about all livestock breeds. And he's probably done more to preserve rare livestock breeds than anybody else. And he is a, you know, should be a Nobel Prize winner for the museum and the number, hundreds of chickens and turkeys and ducks and geese that he keeps on his farms and his neighboring farms. So without further ado, Frank Rees, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Frank,
it might be good afternoon there now.
It is good afternoon. Well, you don't even know time. For you, it's just feeding the turkeys. It's just a day-long, non-stop dealing with turkeys for you, pretty much, right?
Correct. It sure is. Every day, 7 days a week.
Well, we've had you on numerous times, and we, of course, always have you on Thanksgiving. So I figured it'd be interesting this year, post-Thanksgiving, of course, you'll be on other times as well, to tell us about the days. So we're going to go month by month here, and I want to start off with January. You raise, 5 to 10,000 turkeys on your farm, and as well as chickens and other things, but let's talk about the turkeys. So take us through the year. Let's start with January. Tell us about life on the farm on January.
Of course, January is after the Thanksgiving turkeys are gone, so what is kept here now are the breeders for the next new year. So in January is when we clean the barns and get everybody set up and get them ready for the breeding season. So January can be quite busy because it's when we go in and we clean all the buildings.
How many breeds of turkeys do you have, and do you keep them together or apart?
No, in fact, that's what happens in January. I keep 6 different historical or standard bred turkeys breeds here, and they each have to have their own building, their own pens, their own pastures.
All right, and are they having sex?
They will interbreed.
Are they having sex at this time or not? Is it too cold?
No, it's too cold.
They don't want to.
No. The sex comes about, 2 things have to happen. You have to have warmer days, and you have to have more light. And so if you don't do anything artificial, like the factory farms, you know, they produce all that artificially by heating the buildings and keeping the barns lit so they can produce turkeys all year round.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that.
Well, yes, and as a result, you're limited in terms of the number of turkeys, because as we all know, when it's very cold, it's not good for guys to try to, you know, have sex for sure. So now take us to February and March.
Well, by February and March, here in Kansas, it does start to warm up some. This can vary according to the region of the country you're from. As we get into later winter and early spring, the days get longer. And by then, in February, March, the nests the nest boxes are in the building, and the hens are starting to lay eggs.
What do you mean by nest boxes?
Well, we have these very long wooden boxes that we put in the building because turkeys like to climb into something to lay their eggs. And so we have a whole wall of nest boxes that are about 18 inches deep and about 18 inches high and about 12 inches wide, big enough for a turkey hen to go into. And we give her bedding, some wheat straw, and she climbs in there and she starts laying her eggs.
Now, how long after being mounted for a sexual experience does the egg come out? Or how long after sex does she go in there and start rooting around and then have the egg?
Well, of course, they'll start showing signs of what I call doing the turkey dance, in which the hen will pick out the tom she wants to breed with, and she will go and dance in front of him, and she'll circle him around and around and around, and then she'll squat and they'll breed. Now, once they have made contact and the semen is in the hen, she can actually house that semen within her egg sac, within the production area of her body, for up to 2 weeks.
Hmm.
And so that each time she ovulates or lays an egg, she brings in a certain amount of that semen that she has stored and fertilizes the egg.
Very
but
interesting.
She will breed a number of times during that period of laying.
Hmm.
But then once she's laid the egg, you know, then, you know, usually after that, it's quite within a few days where the hormones are changing and she's wanting to have sex with the tom, that she'll go and she'll lay her first few eggs.
Hmm.
And so she will continue to lay eggs from February well into the beginning of late spring.
Now, your job then, I take it, as we get into April and May and this and that, is to grab all these eggs and to bring them across the farm into your hatchery where they are kept warm and then hatch, right?
Yeah, I gather the eggs every day, or often twice or three times a day. You got to prevent the eggs from either getting too cold or too hot. And a lot of times in March in Kansas, you know, we can still have snow and ice, and so the last thing you want are the eggs to freeze. So you have to be quite aware and be out there gathering the eggs the whole time. Yeah, the eggs are gathered every day. They're taken into the hatchery. They're cleaned, and they're stored in a room at 55 degrees. And then once a week, all the eggs are put in the incubator. And I will repeat that for about 3.5 months until I have all the little turkeys hatched.
Now, I remember when I first met you, your incubators looked exactly like the one in The Wizard of Oz, where the mother, before the tornado, takes her to Oz. It was an old little rickety wooden thing, right? And now you have much better.
Yeah, I did originally have what they called the old Lehigh incubators, which held about 600 eggs, and I had two of them. And yeah, they're about 100 years old. They're antiques, and but they were electric. The one in Wizard of Oz would have been kerosene back then, but mine were electric. But they were about 80, 90 years old.
Interesting. And then, but now you have nicer ones. So, okay, so now you're in June and July here, and most of the eggs have been hatched. They've gone from the temperature control 55 to the incubator. Then I see little turkeys still in that room, but then eventually they graduate to an indoor facility in one of your barns, right?
Yeah, the turkeys, I try to get my first little turkeys hatched by the end of March. And then I continue to hatch turkeys every week until May 15th.
Okay.
And the why May 15th is because my turkeys grow at a natural rate. There's a reason why turkeys became the food of Thanksgiving, because back when they had, you know, early Thanksgiving, that's when turkeys were naturally ready for processing, was in late November. And so any turkey that I would hatch, let's say, past May 15th or June 1st, isn't going to be big enough or mature enough to be sold at Thanksgiving time.
Although you did manage to sneak in a few 7-pounders this year, I noticed.
Yeah. And that's usually also because because my turkeys haven't been mutated, mm-hmm. The hens are naturally smaller, just mm-hmm. like in nature.
And they'll come out like 10 to 12 pounds, whereas the toms yeah. naturally come out 18 to 20, right?
Yes.
I've always said that that's a sign.
Of the domesticated fowl. Of the domesticated turkey, yes.
Yeah. I've always said that shows that you're a great turkey farmer, is that your heritage breeds, while remaining completely heritage with none of the commodity genetics, still average, 18 pounds for the toms. That's incredible. When most heritage farmers start, their average weight for toms might be 10 pounds. And I'm like, you have to pick the breeders, and there's a whole art form to that. So take us through the summer, the hot months. I mean, June, July, August, early September. What's going on then, and how does your work change?
Okay. April, May, and June is an extremely busy time because that's when all the babies are coming. So I may have as many as 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 baby turkeys at multiple stages of growth, and so it becomes a huge management issue of maintaining turkeys at different stages of growth, and it can really vary according to what our weather is going to be like here, mm-hmm. On how much they get outside and so on. So you get into there, by the time you get into July and August, and the heat has started to come for the height of summer, and there's no more baby turkeys coming out of the incubators, things get a little better. But then what happens is you get into July and August, that's now the turkeys are outside. And this is when the standard bred or the heritage turkey, which is a natural animal, which can still run, jump, and fly, proceeds to do those very things every day. You'll go outside and you'll have 400 or 500 or 1,000 turkeys, not in the barn, but on top of the barn. Mm-hmm. And then you start that process of teaching them and working with them, of getting them to come back in at night and to just be with them day in and day out as they forage out in the pasture.
And you have animals that help you with that, right? Your dogs and your llamas and your Highland cattle, they protect the flock, right?
They do. They do a certain amount. It all becomes part of a thing that works together. The old type heritage turkeys, though, are far more inquisitive. They love to travel. They love to go and see and do. It's like even today, we have snow. It is about 18 degrees outside, and yet my turkeys are out in the front yard running around. Mm-hmm. They're inquisitive, they're active, and in those summer months, that's another thing. I don't lose turkeys to extreme heat like the factory farms do. Mm-hmm. So that's getting me through July and September. Now, what happens in September and October as we get closer, mm-hmm. now the stress becomes getting enough money to buy enough feed to keep them, because now all of a sudden they're consuming a tremendous amount of feed.
How many pounds does your flock go? I mean, your feed guy delivers what, once a week, once a month?
Once a week.
Wow.
This last year when I was feeding all these turkeys, I was getting 12 tons a week.
12 tons a week?
A week.
Wow. And this, now at this so the point, turkeys the turkeys
were eating
are grown.
About $500 to $600 a feed a day.
Wow. And at this point, they're grown, right? So next comes.
Well, except for these old type heritage turkeys, mm-hmm. unlike the modern industrial turkey, which gets morbidly obese very quickly, my turkeys really don't start putting on that larger breast until they're about 16 weeks of age.
Hmm. Wow, so that's important.
And once they do that, because what they're doing is they're following natural nature's pattern of putting on that extra muscle and weight, because what they're doing is they're not getting ready for market, they're getting ready for winter.
Yeah. For winter, exactly. So now tell us about winter. I mean, I know we're coming up to November. I mean, by now a lot has happened in the turkey project. You've scheduled with the slaughterhouse. You've done estimates of what weight ranges are going to come out of your flock that year. You organize trucks to pick up the live birds. But this is leading up to a very important day where you load all the turkeys into the trucks for the slaughterhouse while also keeping back the best toms and hens hands to populate the next generation, right?
Oh, yeah. October, November is extremely stressful also, because you're exactly right. It is contacting Heritage Foods and working with you, Patrick, and working with your whole team. Of course, the processing plant where the turkeys are taken, we have scheduled a date for that months and months and months in advance. In fact, we've already talked with them about our date for 2014. But it's coordinating the trucks, getting the trucks here. And then here on the farm, it's finding those 15 to 20 to 25 men that it takes to load those turkeys and get them on the trucks. And you can't just put them on a truck. You have to separate the hens from the toms, and you have to load the truck according to how the plant wants them, and to do it in a very humane way. You know, I'm very, very proud that, you know, we don't have all those deaths in transportation with our turkeys.
Yeah,
our
you
turkeys
might lose alive. One bird out of 6,000.
It's amazing. 5,000, we might lose one bird. You're right. In fact, that's what we did this last year. In fact, probably we have one of the nicest compliments ever this year from the USDA inspectors, which are men who see millions of turkeys, said that our turkeys this year were the healthiest, cleanest, most beautiful flock of turkeys they had ever inspected.
Well, fantastic. And, I mean, that's always been true, whether the USDA inspector had the education to recognize that. But, you know, that's no different than it's ever been. And now tell us about December. I mean, then do you feel lonely on the farm now that everything is gone? I mean, not everything, but most of is there a certain...
No, let me tell you, as soon as that truck went off, I looked at my guys and said, okay, we start cleaning. Uh-huh. You know?
Yeah,
you
got to keep it clean.
You know, now you come in with the Bobcats and the dump trucks, and you start cleaning the buildings, and you immediately start scheduling, and you go right on to the next, mm-hmm. to the next project.
Well,
and then also, as you get into winter, you know, it just becomes more work as sure. far as... The heaters have to be plugged in, and, you know, so the water lines don't freeze, and, you know, it's just...
Goes on and on and on. Well,
it just keeps on.
We got to have you on.
It's the natural process of the season.
Yes, no, for sure, and that's kind of what we did today very lightly. I think you're an amazing character, and speaking of which, a movie is being made about... your farm, right? And can you just very briefly tell us about what we should be looking for in the next year or two in terms of Frank in Hollywood?
Well, Jonathan Safran Foer, who wrote the book Eating Animals, which has been a very successful book worldwide, has been purchased and bought by some very important people who are financing to have a movie made of that book. And so I have been working with the director and producer over the last year. They have made numerous trips to my farm to film. And so hopefully that movie will be, you know, come out in 2014 or 2015. I know it takes a while for all that kind of stuff to happen. Mm-hmm. But they've come to tell the story. And I'm just a part of it. They're traveling all around the world.
Yeah.
Filming farmers everywhere.
Well, Frank, you have a beautiful face for the movies. So you look 20 years younger than you really are.
Thank you, Patrick.
I hope you'd get a lot of airtime on there. And I, on the other hand, my face was, God created it more for the radio. But anyway, thank you for everything you do, Frank. I'll be calling you next week to talk more about business, and we should be on many times next year. Thank you for everything you've done and for spending a few minutes away from the birds to be with us today.
Thank you, Patrick, and thank you for all you do for us.
Thanks. Well, we're going to take a very brief break and come back with Goran Ristic and talk about some Serbian food traditions like charcuterie and cheese and after dinner drinks. And then we'll be right back then. Thank you.
You are listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from the main course.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org today.
Well, we are back. That was a very interesting interview with Frank Reese, and we are broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant. I'm Patrick Martins, your host. This is The Main Course, episode 198. Oh, man, 199 is going to be a look back. Episode 200, we have scheduled April Bloomfield of the Spotted Pig Empire. So I'm very excited to have April on. She's never been on my show before. I don't think she's even ever been on the radio network before. So that's very, very, very exciting. 200 shows. I'll be the first to 200, and then I'll let all these other hosts who've been breathing down my neck to be first to 200, and then I will let them pass me. And I am, of course, talking about Beer Sessions and Erica Wide's show, which she's changed the name of her show a couple of years ago, and I can only remember the old name of her. Her is Chef Fancy Pants. What's it called, Joe? Erica Wides' show?
It's called Let's Get Real.
Let's Get Real, of course. What else? I mean, Snacky Tunes is coming up. The Farm Report, even though it's had many hosts, it still counts. I think it's at 191. So, 200. That's four years. It's a legitimate amount of time. Well, we're in studio with Goran Ristic, and we're talking very interestingly about Serbia. And tell us about some of the charcuterie traditions of Serbia. We bond on that when you stop by the office or when I stop by your office. But tell our listeners about some of the traditions there.
So basically, there is not a huge charcuterie, but it's like a lot of cured meats. Because that's like eastern part of Europe and like central Europe during the winter. There is not much things growing around. So if you don't preserve your meats like during the summer and warm days, you're gonna be hungry during the winter. So we have that big tradition of like curing and preserving the meats, and also some vegetables like sauerkrauts and that kind of a pickles and everything else.
What are they called, these meats, for instance? Just prosciutto?
Just prosciutto, bacons, different types of bacons, smoked meats. What do you want?
How do you say bacon in
Slanina?
Slanina?
Slanina, yeah, it's kind of a really hard...
How do you say cured ham, like prosciutto, fresh and...
Shumka.
Shumka?
Yeah, shumka, it's cured ham, that's it.
Now, do you have a fresh cured ham and then like a prosciutto-style ham?
And the prosciutto-style ham, it's a prosciutto.
Prosciutto-style,
that's it.
Yeah, we use that word too here in America. I mean, the Italians have owned it. So you would grow up eating these cured meats? I mean, and they're sold. Is there a big company... Like Boar's Head, for instance, that cures all these meats, or is it more smaller?
The good thing about like all of those like wars and like those like things, what's going on during the 90s, like the like farmers and like the food industry didn't have a chance to develop in the huge industry, so everything was like still in the farms and left like on the same place, so it didn't have like much space to develop. But that's the reason it preserved like really, really good quality, because like you cannot make a huge amount, but you can like dedicate yourself what you are making to make it really good. So that's the beauty of it.
So the supermarkets and the diners and, you know, whatever, wherever you would go to eat there, I mean, the quality of food is solid. I mean, more like than we're used to here.
The supermarkets, like the big, like those like big national companies, they have like some charcuteries and some like salamis and stuff, which are like not that great of quality. But like there is like a lot of small butcher shops when you are actually in the meat markets, when you are actually going to buy your own meat and you know the butcher and you're like, hey, buddy. Mm-hmm. What is this today? What is good? And he like recommend what's serving today. So that's basically how it works. You know your own guy.
A lot of butchers on all the in the small towns also. Is there five butchers in a small town?
There's like 3-4 butchers, yeah. And they're like, there's probably much more, but 3-4 like very successful who are doing the good job. So like you can go and pick your own thing.
So I was thinking, what food traditions? So I'm like, what foods can I ask someone about? And of course it's charcuterie. Cheeses, which you say is mostly a fresh cheese culture there.
Yeah, majority. Like we have like something like very special in that area. It's called kaimak. So that's not a cheese.
Kaimak.
That's like kind of when you're like cooking the milk, the fat layer on the top, what cure, you collect that and layer it with like certain bacteria which like grow up into the kaimak. Same thing like a cheese, but this is like much more like fatty and creamy. It's more like a spread than like a cheese, and it's kind of a really good. Actually, it comes from the Caucasus, like from the Russia, but like the origins are like for all Slavic, majority of the Slavic people are using that, but Serbia is like really famous for a good kaimak.
Very, very cool. And now, of course, the after-dinner drink alcohol tradition. I mean, I know you have beers and wines, of course, but are there some things particular to the former Yugoslavia that are...
Of course.
Packed with alcohol?
Of course. We are like more into like Serbia, it's like a little bit like, and like that area, Balkan, it's like mountain region with a lot of like four seasons, and it's kind of a not very humid, not very dry. No, so it's not very great for wines, but we have a lot of fruits like plums, apples, apricots, and we use those to make booze.
So what like, do you call it? It's not ouzo, is it?
It's a slivovitz, depends. Like
Slivovitz?
Slivovitz, because like plum is šljiva, like that's the name of the fruit. So drink from šljiva, it's šljivovica. So that's, and we have like the apricot one, the like any imaginable fruit you can imagine. We are making it in a like double distillated, very, very potential 65% like hard liquor.
And do more people drink that there per capita than, for instance, here? I mean, is it normal that your father and your mother and you would just...
For example, if you ask my father or like anybody in the morning, what kind of a coffee do you drink? He's like, I'm drinking coffee with rakia, with slivovica. Like that, like in the, like, yeah, we drink a lot of the liquor.
If I remember correctly, in Italy, they call that a caffè corretto.
Exactly.
Corrected coffee.
Yes, that's the one. A slivovitz is like also very similar to grappa, Italian grappa. So it's kind of a, it can be made from the grape also. Like basically all high content sugar fruits can be like made into alcohol. We do that.
Well, very interesting. Well, you know, you are the type of guy who could be a co-host on my show and just kind of hang out there and ask questions now and then and do your own show about all the people you meet and the cultures you know. And, you know, we're big fans of yours. And for people who do not hang out on Siegel Street at the Commissary Kitchen, you can taste the consistency of Goran's work at any of the meatball shops. And they're located throughout the city, Upper East, Chelsea, Williamsburg, Lower East Side.
And we have one in Greenwich Village.
And Greenwich Village. So, you know, they're really all over. And you can taste a little bit of Goran, as I like to say. His hands have touched every ball. That's not true exactly, but or if he does touch him, he's
in
why,
one or the other way, like somehow I'm involved in the whole death process.
He's got balls. And you know, we've got to have you back. There are a lot of people calling in. They heard about a certain bicycle accident where a cat was almost injured. We want to know how the cat is, but we won't subject our listeners to that this time. But next time, it's a reason to come back.
Oh, pleasure would be mine.
Food horror stories, getting to work.
Yeah. Sometimes it's difficult. Too many obstacles on the way.
Yeah. A lot of balls on the road.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you for listening. Our next show is What Doesn't Kill You, hosted by Katie Kiefer. And then we have Mike and Judy's show, which is called Arts and Seizure. Then we have The Morning After, hosted by Jesse Kiefer. And then we have The Snacky Tunes show, hosted by Twin Brothers. So anyway, thank you for listening. And please consider supporting Heritage Radio Network with your nonprofit 501c3 $120 donation, and you'll receive a beautiful tote bag in the mail. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Joe, and thanks to Hearst Ranch.
Listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network.
You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.